Memoria Press now offers 8 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for children with special needs. These full-year packages help you teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art and music, poetry, science, history, Latin, classical and Christian studies in incremental and multisensory ways for mastery. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR9 to save on resources for your home or school.
The current term of art, of course, is identity politics, and some will say this is the way politics has always been in the United States. We've always identified with certain groups. Now we call it identity politics, but it's just old, good old-fashioned American politics. Is that true? Is there something about identity politics that is different? And is there a watershed moment, especially with respect to the sexual revolution, when we can say this is when we began as Americans to find our identity in these classifications like race or gender, you name it, and not where we used to get our identity? Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to talk about the sexual revolution and identity politics, Mary Eberstadt. She's a regular guest, senior fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute in Washington, D.C. She's authored numerous books, including her latest, Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. Mary, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Why does the story of the post-1960s crack-up of the American family need to be told?
Well, my argument is that it needs to be told because it's at the root of a lot of the problems we're facing today. And there's great resistance to acknowledging this, but I think more and more of us have a feeling that something's gone badly wrong for our country and our society. Politics is divisive. We have a drop in life expectancy for the first time in recorded history, the opioid epidemic, and lots of other stresses. And what I'm asking people to do is take a look at what I'm arguing is the root cause of this, which are the radical changes in the way that we live in families since the 1960s. And we can get into some of the data on that later, but that's primarily what I'm asking for, is a radical new look at what ails us.
What is identity politics?
Well, you know, these days, identity politics seems to be everywhere, but it wasn't always thus. And when people say, well, we've always had identity politics, no, they're making a mistake. We've always had a tendency to identify with larger groups to advance our interests, like political parties. But identity politics means something very specific. It is a grievance-driven way of doing politics in which you take your political direction from the aggrieved group that you identify with. And again, this is very new on the American scene. Identity politics, sociologists agree, begins in 1977 with a document that was put out by a group of radical African American feminists. And in that document, they say that they're giving up on the idea of allying with men, and they're giving up on the idea that anyone has their best interests at heart apart from members of the group. And this is a very transformative step in American politics, because after that declaration came many grievance groups based on ethnicity, based on now gender identification, based on all kinds of characteristics. But the founding document was created in 1977, so that's how recent identity politics is.
Why does the mere mention of the sexual revolution often generate what you call psychological resistance?
Well, partly because just about everybody's implicated in some aspect or another. Our society has been transformed by things like divorce, abortion, cohabitation. And, you know, we all have friends and family members who are part of this. So part of the resistance is just not wanting to offend people, of course. I'm not making an offensive argument. I'm not, like, fingering any particular decision or behavior at all. What I'm asking us to do is look at the collective impact of all of these phenomena, which have served to reduce the family, reduce it in size, reduce its gravitational pull, reduce it by very often having homes without both biological parents in them. So I'm asking us to look at the big picture here.
You use the term system-wide familial dislocation. What do you mean by that, Mary?
The changes of the sexual revolution are now affecting us at every stage of life. So, for example, in the beginning, it was easiest to measure the effects on children. So there was a lot of study by sociologists on children of fatherless homes in particular, and the adverse consequences. There was big argument about how adverse the consequences of this were, etc. Well, that was just in the beginning, but now, some six decades into the sexual revolution, we're seeing something at the other end of life. We are seeing what sociologists call an epidemic of loneliness in all of the advanced countries of the world. And to see this, all you need to do is Google the word loneliness studies and any country that you can think of that's materially well off. So what is this loneliness epidemic about? Well, fundamentally, it's about what happens when people are not living in families. It's about millions of decisions not to have children, to have smaller families. And the result is that many people, again, ironically, in the materially best off nations, are reaching the end of life without people to accompany them there. So that's a face of the sexual revolution that we're only just beginning to understand. But that's what I mean by system-wide dislocation. From cradle to grave now, we are seeing the sexual revolution reshape our lives.
Is this why you use the term the great scattering?
Yes, because I was trying to come up with an image that summarizes what's happened to our family life. And of course, this is situated in a context. It's not just our family life. It's also our communal life, the Robert Putnam famously documented the decline in community life in a couple of books, most prominently Bowling Alone. So we have civic disengagement going on at the same time that we have this familial disengagement. And the result, I argue in the book, is that people are desperate for the building blocks of identity because what they used to have in the way of identity is not available to many of them anymore. So we see this frantic race toward collective identities that will somehow take the place of community and family and church, which is another aspect of this argument.
Obviously, identity politics didn't suddenly appear. You spoke a moment ago about the document that kind of marks its beginning, but what are its precursors?
Well, in one chapter of the book, I go through the 1970s and 80s and the phenomenon of multiculturalism, because multiculturalism turns out to be closely related to identity politics. In multiculturalism, we were already seeing this desire to attach to another culture, or this desire to recover one's own supposed culture, and to hold that up against Western civilization, as Western civ was the big bad culture, and the other cultures were supposed to be better. So already in multiculturalism, we see this intense divisiveness, this zero-sum mentality, that it's all us or them, that we're not united as Americans. Instead, we're divided by whatever it might be. So that's why I say these phenomena are closely related, but identity politics has come to take center stage.
So multiculturalism was essentially this notion that all cultures are equally, I'm grasping for a word here, not valid, but were moral and social equivalents of one another. Is that a good way of understanding multiculturalism?
Yes, except that as it played out, all cultures were equal and equally valid, except for Western civilization, which was constantly held to be inferior in some respect.
So how does identity politics feed into something that you note and document in your book, and that is the increasing narcissism of young Americans.
Well, the argument of the book is that we are living very unnaturally for the social creatures that we are. Human beings are social animals, and like all social animals, we are meant to live in community of some kind. And I don't mean that in some sort of abstract, sentimental way. We see, especially among the young, problems that didn't exist before. Experts agree that there's been a sharp rise in psychiatric trouble, particularly anxiety and depression, among young people. And there is a great discussion about what's causing this. And, of course, social media, rightly, I think, gets some of the blame. Being on our phones all the time gets some of the blame. But I connect the dots in a different way to say, surely some of this psychiatric trouble among young people is coming about because they are more disconnected from family than the generations that came before them. And what I mean is, again, the family is smaller. Very few people live in extended families anymore. A lot of people are growing up as only children. A lot of people grow up with one sibling. And the reason this matters is that there's a lot of research to show that the way people are socialized is by looking to their siblings and their parents. So when you have a world in which fewer people have those things, you have a world in which, obviously, loneliness is on the rise. And psychiatric trouble, arguably, is another manifestation of that problem.
Why do you think this problem of the increase of psychological problems and narcissism impacts young women so profoundly? You note that in your book.
I do, Todd. I think that I have an entire chapter, in fact, about feminism, which I think is a misunderstood phenomenon. And by feminism, I'm talking about the kind of feminism that we see in the streets, you know, the kind of feminism that was behind the resistance, this, you know, very angry, belligerent, coarse feminism that I think is taking on these kind of masculine characteristics, these swaggering characteristics, because deep down, I think feminists and many women feel vulnerable. The sexual revolution has left them more vulnerable than they were before. I think we saw this very clearly in the hashtag MeToo movement, where we saw story after story from women, most of them young women, the beneficiaries of elite education, you know, who were working in elite fields like Hollywood and the media. And yet, all of these advantages didn't protect them against serial predation in many cases. So I think that underneath this kind of swagger and this insistence that the future is feminine, there is a deep anxiety about what's happened to the world that is not articulated within feminism, but that feminism is definitely expressing otherwise.
Many associate identity politics with tribalism. Mary Eberstadt says, not so fast. We'll find out why after the break. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. The 8th Century. The 4th Century. The best of the Church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Contending for Truth in an Age of Anti-Truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
College Preparation Station is proud to announce the opening of its first Missouri location, Creve Coeur. College Preparation Station provides ACT, SAT, PSAT instruction, and college scholarship guidance. Their new Creve Coeur branch is located at 11,500 Olive Boulevard. Learn more at cpsprep.com or call 314-750-5967. College Preparation Station in Creve Coeur, Missouri, and Maryville, Illinois. cpsprep.com.
Things when I hear on the radio tonight about Obama being a Christian, but not being good because of his pro-choice and homosexuality stances.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
Yet I see no evidence of any literature that in the Bible that you stated that says that these things are against biblical teachings.
The Issues Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
Mary Eberstadt is our guest. She's senior fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute in Washington, D.C., and author of numerous books, including her latest, Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. We're talking about those two things together on this Friday afternoon. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Mary, many people associate identity politics with tribalism, but you say that to think of identity politics in terms of tribe really has a serious flaw in it. What is that?
Well, yeah, it's become very common. I say that it's the it word of punditry these days to talk about tribalism and to, you know, lament the fact that the United States seems to be divided into tribes. But that is a faulty metaphor because tribes themselves are not just packs of, you know, random people. Tribes themselves come out of the family. And so in talking about our problems in America as if they're tribal problems, that kind of language lets us just gloss over the possibility that maybe our problems are coming from a deeper place, a more primordial place, which is the family itself. And that's what I'm trying to get at in getting away from this tribes metaphor.
So the tribe metaphor, because tribe is based on family itself or extended family, is pretty much exactly the opposite of what is occurring in identity politics.
Yes, because I think what's occurring in identity politics is a deep and frantic drive to attach oneself to a group that can answer the question, who am I? And that in itself is a remarkable thing, Todd, that we live in a time when so many people seem not to know who they are. Well, how could this be? And in the book, I get into what I think are the reasons for it. For example, let's look at secularization. Let's look at the fact that fewer and fewer people are going to church. Well, one fallout from that is that church provides you with an answer to that question, who am I? Because to a Christian and to other religious believers too, the answer to the question, who am I, is I am a child of God, right? Church gives you a ready-made identity and a handy answer to that question. Well, similarly, being in a family gives you answers to that question. Who am I? I'm a son, I'm a cousin, I'm an uncle, I'm a father. But fewer and fewer people are able to answer the question, who am I, with resort to things like that. For example, are you a son? Are you a stepson? Are you still related to that person who was the child of someone your mother married and divorced? There are all kinds of questions like this. There are fundamental questions of identity that people are living with day in and day out because of the way the world has changed.
Much of your book is kind of laying out the evidence for your theory of the Great Scattering. What did you find in the social sciences by way of evidence for that?
Well, there's a great deal of evidence in the social sciences about the problems that developed once marriage was in decline. And to say that is not to glorify or romanticize the married state unnecessarily, but it is to say that clearly fatherlessness has been linked with some adverse outcomes for a lot of kids. I believe in James Q. Wilson's monumental book on crime, he showed that over 90% of the inmates of maximum security prisons had grown up without a father in the home. So it's that kind of evidence about the behavioral outcomes for some kids of not having a father. And there's a lot of sociology on that that's pertinent to the thesis of the book.
You say there was even a tipping point at some point in American history where the fatherlessness in the African-American community went over 50%. Why was that so significant?
That happens in the exact same year that the document I mentioned earlier was published. This is 1977. And what's interesting about that is this is the first generation to have come of age during the sexual revolution, obviously. And the fact that the document was written by radical African-American feminists also tells us something, because at that time, African-Americans were on the cutting edge of these new trends. Out-of-wedlock births had risen first and highest there, and rates of marriage were in decline. And what was true back in 1977 for them would soon become true for the whole country. So I think it's no coincidence that at the same time you see these trends really start to skyrocket, this first document saying that we don't trust anyone else to have our backs but ourselves is issued. So the sexual revolution and identity politics are obviously joined at the root.
What evidence did you find in history for the great scattering theory?
Well, it's hard to find historical evidence in the sense that we are living in a radically different way than the people who came before us. There have been wars and cataclysms and, you know, other events that have really knocked the family around in different times and places. But we are the first ones to do this and declare that it's good and refuse to look hard at the consequences of the way that we live now. By way of analogy, Todd, I have some research in the book that's about the behavior of other species, because sometimes I think it's so hard to break through the resistance to this kind of subject that we have to point to other species to do it. So, for example, in the matter of elephants, there's been a lot of scholarly work on the importance of elephant community, primarily elephant family. Baby elephants stay within 15 feet of their mothers for the first 8 years of life, for example, and they live with their mothers all their lives. It's stuff like that. So we can see very clearly when we disrupt the familial structure of other creatures that there are adverse consequences there. When you take elephants out of their family situation, they rampage and they kill people sometimes and just generally act out in ways that can be pretty dangerous because they're elephants. We see very clearly that taking them out of the kind of structure they were meant to live in is terrible for them. But what we need to do is apply that lesson to ourselves.
So in other words, in something as simple as the familial relationship in a different species, we can observe and be, well, at this point, I was going to say forewarned, but it's too late now, that we cannot tinker with even the most basic relationship of mother to child without expecting serious consequences on a large scale.
Well, yes, absolutely. Again, we see this quite clearly in the case of other species, and that's one reason why elephants are no longer to be found in circuses, because we understand their intensely social nature. And what's true for elephants is true across the animal kingdom, as it turns out. And it was very interesting to see how much research has been devoted to that in the last 10 years alone, just documenting the intensely familial nature of the life of mammals particularly. So as I mentioned in the book, just for instance, the idea that there's such a thing as a lone wolf, you know, this myth of the lone wolf is actually false. We now know wolves are almost never alone. They exist in very tight nuclear families, as do coyotes and as do a bunch of other animals named in the book. And I do think this is pertinent to us. Of course, we're very different from the animals, but in some ways, we're very much like them. And so, yes, if we tinker with something as basic as the social structure into which we were born and, you know, through which all previous generations have lived, we should expect some pretty massive consequences from that experiment. And I think that's what we're seeing.
What evidence did you find for the Great Scattering Theory in current events? I imagine that was a pretty rich source for you.
Well, what I do is to examine identity politics up close. And what I mean by that is examine its language and its manifestations. So, for example, there have been very surreal scenes on college campuses in the name of identity politics. You have protests about Halloween. You have this mania about, quote, cultural appropriation. And what I do is get into that language and say, this is primal language. This stuff about this is mine and you can't have it and no one else can touch it because this is mine and this is me. You know, this is really pre-rational. And again, I think it's because there is just a terrible insecurity about identity, such that if an object floats within view that conceivably you can call your own, that taco is mine because I'm Mexican-American and I'm the only one who can have it and I'm the only one who gets to say that. You know, this kind of language that we're seeing on the campuses, I think, is springing from a really primal place. One of the problems we're dealing with is that this, it has insinuated itself into our politics. This deep irrationalism is now reconfiguring the way we are trying to govern ourselves. So that's a pretty weighty issue there.
You use the term infantilized for a lot of what's happening on our campuses. I have very small grandchildren, 3 and below, and I watch their behavior in terms of that, as you have a whole chapter on the mine of identity politics. This kind of behavior being practiced by, in some cases, college educators, sometimes people who are being educated in college. Is that what you're talking about? Just behaving like children?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm talking about, because that's what's happening out there. I cite, for example, an op-ed piece in the New York Times that was published not too long after the election, where the author was just so furious, and she said she didn't want to listen to nonsense about due process. She just wanted to, you know, sit with her rage headache, is how she put it. Well, anyone who's been around a toddler knows what that looks like. That's somebody sitting with, you know, hands over ears, refusing to engage with adult conversation. And there are a lot of other examples that are in the book of how these manifestations of identity politics really look like they're coming from a kind of arrested development. And I don't say that to mock it. I think it's somewhat frightening, but I also think it's really pathetic in the sense that we should resonate to the pain there and try to understand it. And that's what I'm trying to do in Primal Screams.
I noticed this in my own interaction, in this case online, I think about a year ago, when the term of cultural appropriation was all the rage. It simply occurred to me to post on Twitter at some point that all culture is appropriated. None of it is original. We borrow everything in our culture from some other culture, some other part of history. Got a pretty angry response from a lot of people. What do you make of that?
Well, I think the subject of identity has just become so fraught that people no longer respond rationally. Now, I'm not saying there aren't real grievances out there. For example, it makes sense that to a Native American and to other people, an object, say, sacred to such a person in their culture that's used for mockery or used, you know, to make fun of, like I give the example of Victoria's Secret models parading down a runway in headdresses, which caused a huge outcry. That, to me, makes perfect sense, that there would be a legitimate feeling that one's culture had been intruded upon. But a lot of what's happening in identity politics does not make perfect sense at all. And my point is that if we had a more rational kind of political conversation going, we could adjudicate cases like this. You know, we could adjudicate cases about Confederate statues and have a reasoned conversation about things like that. But the level of emotion is so high when it comes to identity politics. When you have near riots at a place like Yale University over Halloween costumes, it's very hard to engage that kind of incivility in a rational way.
Mary Eberstadt is our guest, senior fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute in Washington, D.C. She says that feminism and progressivism have embraced a coarsening of our rhetoric and our language. We'll find out why they've done that next.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
We're discussing the sexual revolution and identity politics with Mary Eberstadt of the Faith and Reason Institute. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. regular guest Dr. Gene Edward Veith writes a monthly column on Christianity and culture for the Lutheran Witness magazine. The Lutheran Witness is available in print and online. Check it out at cph.org/witness, cph.org/witness. Mary, picking up on that theme of anger, kind of, as you say, kind of pre-rational reactions that we get in the political sphere, why have feminism and progressivism more generally embraced a coarsening of our language and rhetoric?
Well, again, I don't think this is well understood, but from watching it for quite a while, I believe what's happened is this. In a world where men are more elusive, let's say, either because they don't want to get married or because dad left home or whatever the case may be, or the smaller family, the fact that a lot of women don't have brothers, male cousins, uncles, and, you know, these kind of figures in their lives who are non-romantic companions, you know, related companions. When you have a world like that, where a lot of women don't know male companionship, I think what happens is that they toughen up and they express themselves more and more in male ways. And I think this is what we're seeing in the transformation of feminism from what used to be this, you know, liberated, bra-burning bunch of happy people to where the sexual revolution has led these many years later, which is to Me Too and a generalized kind of fury among some women against men. So there's a chapter in the book where I lay this out and say that the effect of the sexual revolution has been to raise the cultural incentives for women to behave more like men. And it has also, for different reasons, raised the cultural incentives for men to behave more like women. That is, that both sexes are being pushed more towards an androgynous mean.
You have talked about feminism as a survival strategy. Make the case for that, if you would.
Well, in a world where men can't be relied on, women will act more like men. And that's what I mean about a survival strategy. It's an adaptation to a changed world. And let me give you a specific example, Todd, of where I think we see this. Let's go back to hashtag Me Too. So I read many of those stories, and they're horrible stories. And, you know, hopefully courts will adjudicate, you know, who did what. But there was something missing from these stories, and it took me a while to figure out what it was. And that is almost never in these stories about sexual harassment and worse, almost never was there the appearance of, say, a related male figure who might have been counted on to push back against, you know, this the kind of wrongs that were described by all these women. So there were no brothers, no fathers. It doesn't sound like anybody in their lives had these women's backs in that very traditional way of being a protector. And I don't mean to sound like we need to go back to caveman times and, you know, hit people over the head and drag them off into the caves. That's not what this is about. But it was stunning how almost none of those women making these accusations of terrible behavior against men seem to have turned to a brother or a father or a cousin or, you know, tried to bring someone like that into the picture. There were a couple of mentions of boyfriends playing a protective role and going to the supposed offenders and trying to stop the behavior, but that was very rare as well. And so I just thought that was a striking feature of hashtag Me Too, you know, and that it said a lot about where we are and how estranged the sexes have become from each other.
Are you saying that feminism in its kind of 1960s form is unwittingly a response to something that came before, a deficit in both the family and male responsibility?
Well, one thing the sexual revolution did was make it harder to form families for a lot of reasons. I mean, a lot of men have not wanted to stop the party that is the sexual revolution and, you know, get married. Marriage rates have declined, and also people are marrying later, and et cetera. So, yes, I think from the very beginning, feminism, you know, the embracing of this identity that, what am I first and foremost? I am a feminist. I'm like a sister. That use of the word sister is also pretty telling. People are forming this kind of feminist quasi-family because it's gotten harder to form a non-quasi-family, a real family. And this pattern keeps, like, repeating over time.
Talk more about what you call in the book a gravitation toward an androgynous mean.
Well, one thing that has struck a lot of people is this current, you know, nonstop news about gender fluidity and all this, you know, kind of gender confusion. How could you not know who you are? You know, this kind of thing. I think it's coming from a really deep place. And to take one example, we now live in a world where about half of all kids will grow up without their biological father in the home. And in almost all cases, mom gets custody. And to be a single mother is indeed a heroic thing. It's hard to imagine how people do it. But it is also very often to send a signal to the children of such a household, especially male children, that men are bad. This is just one common sense consequence, and nobody means for it to happen. But to be on the receiving end of that message and to be, say, a young boy, is to learn early on that your masculinity is a problem. And so I think with these, like, deep reshapings of the condition of the family, some outcomes include that boys get the message that it's better to be a little more like a girl. And how could they not?
Does feminism have a corresponding survival strategy among men? Is there a parallel among men to feminism?
Well, men don't need it as much because, frankly, they're the victors in the situation, or at least predatory men are the victors in the situation. They have been emboldened by the sexual revolution. But I do think the idea of being somehow less male has trickled pretty far down in a lot of psyches. And one way of testing that is to see just how much young men embrace the work of Jordan Peterson, for example, someone who gives them permission to be masculine, you know, somebody who says toxic masculinity is a bad idea, you know, to be masculine is a good thing. Well, they embrace work like that because they don't hear a lot of it from the surrounding culture, because what the surrounding culture says, again, is men are bad. Masculinity is toxic. Toxic masculinity is the reason for a lot of our problems. So that's one example, Todd, of where I think we really have to get away from these abstractions like the patriarchy and toxic masculinity and so on, you know, gender normativity. these abstractions are not doing anybody any good. We need to speak in much plainer language about what's driving this sense of loss and grievance, and connecting it to the changed family structure in which more and more of us are living.
The impulse for the average person who's concerned about identity politics, ironically, is sometimes to kind of engage in their own identity politics. It tends to kind of spark that reaction in us. If we see someone who's identifying as feminist, then there's this kind of impulse to say, all right, so what's my identity that I can use to counter what I believe is the dangers of feminism? Why is that a terrible strategy?
Well, I think it's a self-defeating strategy, because already feminism has made itself separatist and exclusionary. And since optimally the sexes work together, I think the last thing we need is for men to retreat at the same time that women are retreating.
How do you account for the failure of feminism to see that the Me Too movement, or the things that sparked the Me Too movement, are in fact the results of the sexual revolution? Men under feminism usually come out, as you say, predatory men, as the winners. Why doesn't feminism account for that?
I don't think feminism understands itself at this point. Its insistence that abortion is primary, for example, that is really practically a central sacrament of feminism at this point, such that now we're talking about abortion up until the moment before birth. Women, among other things they are nurturers. And to have the nurturing sex, if I might put it that way, embrace this ghastly, absolutist approach to the unborn is just one example of the contradictions of feminism at this point, the way that it really has ceased to make sense, except as a collective identity in which women who join that identity somehow feel safer.
Why is an analysis of identity politics really more about anthropology than about politics itself?
Well, Todd, as mentioned, I think identity politics is pre-politics. We're not sitting around debating Aristotle and which way his thought would point. This is about something primal. It's about that question, who am I, that human beings have to answer for themselves one way or another. So I say it's anthropological because what is raised by identity politics is the question of the human person. You know, what is the human person about? In what conditions does the human person thrive? And these kinds of questions are more about philosophy than they are about politics. And they're important questions.
You say that the sexual revolution is bedrock for progressives of all stripes, whether or not they are advocates of identity politics. What do you mean by that?
Well, this goes back to an argument that was started among liberals and progressives right after the election of President Trump. Mark Lilla, a Columbia University professor and a liberal, wrote a piece in the New York Times that's followed by a book. And his argument was that identity politics was terrible for the liberal left because it would lose elections and because it divided people up, because it left them with no sense of what it meant to be an American. And his argument caused a huge uproar, with most people on the liberal left seeming to be against him. Now, I found that whole argument really interesting, because if you consider what I'm arguing are the causes of our divisiveness, you know, and the causes of identity politics, which is this fact that we've drifted so far from a structured family life that we can't answer that question, who am I, easily anymore. If the problem is the sexual revolution, the liberal left is the last place to look for solutions to that, because of the embrace of abortion, the embrace of no-fault divorce, the insistence that these radical changes in family life are inconsequential. So if identity politics is a problem, the liberal left is the last place to look for solutions.
What is a way forward away from our obsession with identity?
Well, I'm actually quite hopeful, believe it or not, because I can think of examples from history of times when something got out of control and went too far and was bad for people, and a new social consensus was adopted on account of that. For example, in Victorian England, in pre-Victorian England, there were what was called the gin alleys. There was a massive addiction to gin, and it seemed to be everywhere, and it seemed to be just the way the world was, and that was never going to change. But then came the Victorian reformers, and they cleaned up the streets, and they ameliorated the drug problem. And this pattern has also been repeated in other drug epidemics. And it's one reason why I'm hopeful about this, because for all that our politics has become pre-rational, especially identity politics, people are still rational creatures, and they respond to evidence. And they respond to evidence of harm over time as well. So in holding up a mirror to these kinds of things, what I'm hoping is that people will take a second look and that some kind of social change will be affected over time.
You ask this question, what is the nonstop obsession with identity telling us about ourselves? In brief, what is the answer to your question?
It's telling us that we are so disconnected from the kind of structures in which we are meant to live as social animals that we often can't even answer that question, who am I? So it's telling us that we are experiencing confusion and frustration on a scale about a very important question, on a scale that we have not seen before. We need to look at why so many people are so insecure about their very identities, and that's what I try to do in the book.
Mary Eberstadt is a senior fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute in Washington, D.C. She's author of numerous books, including her latest, Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. When you purchase this book using the Amazon link at our website, a percentage of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Talk on Demand Archives, and look for Primal Screams by Mary Eberstadt. Mary, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
When we return, it's This Week in Pop Christianity. Today, Joel Osteen's View of Sin. Pastor Chris Rosebro will be with us.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's Classical Christian Curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press. Saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Lutheran Federal Credit Union offers mortgage and auto loans, checking and savings accounts, credit and debit cards. During August, if you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or if you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to Lutheran Friends of the Deaf. Learn more at lutheranfcu.org. Good for you, good for the church. Lutheran Federal Credit Union, lutheranfcu.org.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans and their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armed forces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. lcms.org/armed forces.
Discover a truly Lutheran approach to education. Concordia University Chicago's Center for the Advancement of Lutheran Liberal Arts supports a vibrant, growing community of classical educators. Whether you're a teacher, administrator, parent, or homeschooler, we have the resources and contacts you need to start a child's journey into the Lutheran liberal arts. Visit cuchicago.edu/calla. That's C-A-L-L-A.